the topic that I chose to speak at, I'm going to speak over this way because our guests are over here. During this spring semester at colleges, I visited a number of universities and chose to speak on this topic, exercising compassion in contemporary life. And I'd like to give a little explanation of why I chose the topic. It's on the personal side. 2 years ago, I had a very interesting experience of serving as the chairman of the governing body commission for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. It was a very exercising opportunity of service. And one of the things that happened in the course of that year, towards the second half of the year, was the disaster in Haiti. And in the past, something like that, my experience was like so many other people, like a passenger in a train. You're riding in a train, and you get on the train, and you go to a destination, and you get off the destination. In between, you might see something out the window that looks awful. And you're like, oh, that's awful, and you keep going on the train, like life. But being chairman, I was like in the conductor's cabin, and I was thinking, I need to do something. I'm the chairman of this international spiritual organization, and this disaster just happened. So we need to do something. And I had to think about what to do. Instead of just like commenting, oh, that's awful. So I didn't know what to do. I had no training, no preparation, no protocol, just like, what do you do? And then some mails started coming saying, what are we going to do? And I don't know what to do. So we don't have a temple in Haiti. There's a temple in Santo Domingo, but I know the temple in Santo Domingo is like, it's tiny. They don't have the capacity to do anything. So there's one devotee I know who lives in Santo Domingo, and he's young, energetic, intelligent, very responsible, conscientious, very caring. So I called him and said, would you like to coordinate an international effort to help in the Haiti disaster? And right away he said, sure. So I said, okay, get ready to receive phone calls and emails from people from all around the world that are going to want to come and do something. He said, no, I don't have a clue what to do either, but I'll take it and run with it. So more calls and more emails, and just forward them to this devotee. And by the end of the whole exercise, about 40 plus, 42 devotees from around the world went to Haiti to help. They had some fundraising had taken place, and I had the opportunity of flying into London to take part in the meeting, and met about 12 of them because they had planned to meet there and then take a direct flight to Haiti. And it just happened, it wasn't planned, it just happened that we met one another. And one fellow from Australia, who his thing was he knew how to build houses from next to nothing. That was pretty useful because there was next to nothing to work with. And somebody else was good at first aid, and somebody else was good at... One devotee from Sweden knew how to do sustainable gardening, and instead of clothing in his suitcases, was bags full of seeds, and that was what was on his way to Haiti. And then, a whole group of people doing different things. And I said, this is really amazing. What about the spiritual well-being of all these people? And they said, oh, we have that plan too. We, ahead of time, we shipped some books in French to Haiti, Prabhupada's books, and we have beads so we can, because when you're putting, helping people put their lives back together, it's not just their homes and their food, it's their spiritual, they're shattered. So we've done this before and we know how to do this. We'll to help them pull their lives together spiritually and reach out to God. So it's like, wow. And then other people and other people. We have a farm, a very successful farm in Hungary, and they sent almost 10 devotees because they felt, you know, we're successful. Here's some people that need some help. So let's just carve out some time from our life. It was in June. It was in the summer. So that's like, you know, busy time on the farm, but we have to take some time out and do something to help people. So they sent a bunch of people. And it was awesome. I didn't get a final report of how many people went for how much time and how much money they spent and what they did, but the pieces that I got back was, it was incredible. And then the rest of the year was passing, and towards the end of my tenure, something similar, not quite at the same scale, happened in Chile. And I thought, oh my God, we have to do something. But Chile was a lot easier because there's a temple, in, at least in the country of Chile, in Santiago, the capital. And so, you know, with a little encouragement, the rest of the Latin American group of devotees, they did something together. And then my tenure of GBC ended, and I didn't have to think about it anymore because I had a lot of other things I was not thinking about while I was GBC, while I was that chairman. And then some time passed, and this thing just happened in Japan. And I thought, same thing. Gee, we have to do something. And I want more than just do something. I want to speak about it because it's an important topic. So that's the background here. And during this fall visit to colleges, at several of them, there was an arrangement. The first one was at Penn State, and we invited the Japanese student organization to take part with the Vedic Vision and put on a program specifically related to the disaster in Japan. We had at the end a fundraising dinner, and whatever funds were, whatever people gave, it just went into this helping in Japan, because I had done some research, and at that point there were 34 devotees in Japan from out of the country. One local devotee was organizing, and 28 of them had come from Nepal. I don't know why Nepal, but they went from Nepal to Japan to help. And their restrictions were mainly two things. They couldn't go close to where the radioactive area was, which was in great need, and they had lack of funds, so we just were trying to supply them some funds and promote some awareness. And did that at a few other places, MIT and some other places. So that's the background of why this topic, and the way that I began the presentation, I'll begin here also. A picture of a lotus, and in different parts of the world, lotus flower represents different things. It can just represent the epitome of beauty in nature. It sometimes symbolizes peace and tranquility. Sometimes it has specific religious connotation for some groups of people. And I shared with the students, for me, it represents the compassion of Krishna. And in the following way, in the Vedic picture of things, there's unlimited numbers of universes. I mean, there's finite, but so many you can't count them. It says as many mustard seeds as there are in a big bag of mustard seeds, each of them representing a universe. That's so many universes. And each of the universes is like a coconut. It's hollow in the center, and it has a hard shell. And inside the universe, there's so many planets. And then there's a diameter of that hollow portion inside. And the outside is layers, seven in number. Each is ten times greater than the previous layer. And the first layer is equal to the diameter of the universe. So when you do the math, it's like if you have a little marble that's maybe 3/4 of an inch in diameter, the covering of the universe goes out a couple of miles. And outside of the universe, there's the vastness of the spiritual sky. And within the vastness of the spiritual sky, there's spiritual planets called Vaikuntha planets. And amongst those Vaikuntha planets, the largest amongst them is Krishna Loka, that's shaped like a lotus. And on top of the world, the central portion, is where Krishna and the cowherd boys and the gopis and River Jamuna and Govardhan Hill and the whole pastimes of Krishna are performed, where he's very compassionately giving his loving association to all the residents in Vrindavan and forever inviting all the conditioned souls to come and join him. So the lotus to me represents the compassionate nature of Krishna. So I'll start with a few definitions taken directly from the internet. These are definitions of compassion. They have different components. One of them reads, compassion is the quality of understanding the suffering of others and wanting to do something about it. So three parts. It's a quality. It includes understanding of others' suffering. And there's an active component. Do something about that suffering of others. And another definition is a deep awareness and sympathy for another's suffering. So that it sounds similar, but here's some of the distinction. It's a quality, something that you feel deep within the core of your being, and there's a compelling dimension of caring, that compelling caring fuels an urge to act on what you feel. After I made the presentation at Penn State, one of the organizers of the event sent me a link to a YouTube site where a TED speaker. Any of you know what TED is? T-E-D? It's probably an acronym, but it's an organization that features really quality speakers, and they have all these rules, and they select very carefully speakers that become TED speakers, and they have 20 minutes, and there's certain things that they must accomplish within those 20 minutes. And it's like it's an honor to be a TED speaker. So the link that they sent me was to a Google employee who was speaking about compassion. And he's a Chinese gentleman who his theme was how at Google they're success is driven by compassion. It's embedded within the culture of Google that they're compassionate. And he gave examples of what Google employees do that are compassionate. Then two other things. He explained that although he's an engineer by training, then he chuckled and said, they've given me a full-time job of training a seminar in compassion. Because compassion isn't just being soft, it's being successful. And he gave the example of a book, the author of whom I can't remember, but the title of the book is From Good to Excellent, describing a corporate culture where a leadership that's good has the following qualities, but excellence has two specific qualities: humility and an intense desire to accomplish or achieve. And he tied them to this chart. This is just a reproduction of his chart. It has the very same definitions of the ones that I showed you from the dictionary. Or there's three components in compassion: affective, I feel for you; cognitive, I understand you; and motivational, I want to do something for you. So what he did was, he said in this seminar, that's like compulsory seminar for all their people because they want them to be not just good, they want them to be excellent. So he's moved this definition of compassion into a seminar that's excellence. They're striving for excellence at Google. And it has this component of humility and ambition. The ambition is to fulfill these features of humility. The humility dimension is where false ego is out of the way. There are leaders that will step on anybody to achieve their ends. And the humble leader is one who is thinking about the persons they're trying to serve. They understand the persons that they're trying to serve and their needs. They feel, this is like in the corporate environment particularly, not just, you know, the customer, but it's both, where they're aware of the needs of their fellow employees as well as the customer, and they have some feelings for them. And that's possible because they're humble, or it helps their compassionate nature helps them feel for and understand the people that they work with and the people they're trying to serve, particularly service organizations. And then a very strong drive to fulfill these things. Just like, you know, if you want to do something for somebody, it's best connected with something you understand about them and some feeling for them. So he's... I'm trying to get a copy of his curriculum because I think it would be really good for our spiritual organization to have, a Krishnaized version of how to be excellent in our performance of serving others. Because that's what Google is, it's a service organization. There's some quotes on compassion that I'd like to share. And some of them are contemporary, some of them are ancient. Here's a modern individual who you all recognize. Here's what Einstein said about compassion. Our task must be to free ourselves by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature and its beauty. I have a god sister whose name is Saradiya, and she heard, because it's in Lord Chaitanya's teachings, that the chanting of the holy name, like we were just doing, it's the prime benediction for all living beings. So she asked Prabhupada, is it okay? Is it a good idea? Would you recommend that while chanting we should be thinking this chanting of the holy name is the prime benediction for all living beings, it's for the welfare of all living beings? Prabhupada's reply was, how can you think of all living beings? What's your capacity to think of all living beings? Better you think of the holy name when you're chanting, and the holy name will give benediction to all living beings. the element of compassion, in Einstein's words, is a key to freedom. Certainly he had a lot of freedom, capacity to think out of the box or think in a free thinking way, and he's expressing that the key to that freedom was compassion. And just keep widening the circle of that compassion to that which is beyond even our capacity to comprehensively think about, but let it embrace all living creatures, the whole of nature and its beauty. It's liberating. It's freeing. And this is an individual who you also all recognize. Dalai Lama expressed, "If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion." Because normally, compassion has the connotation of wanting others to be happy. So you want others to be happy, practice compassion. But by so doing, you become happy. So even if your thinking is, "I want to be happy," you're not so much thinking about how others will be happy. Be compassionate, or practice it, and others will be happy. It's a different perspective on the same thing that Einstein had to say. It's freeing, it's liberating. It's not a burden. It's wonderful. You become happy, others become happy through exercising compassion. Christ also spoke about compassion, obviously. And here is one of the statements he made: "Knowledge and ritual without compassion is empty." So any religion, whether it's Christianity or any religion, has some ritual involved in it and some teaching involved in it. Several years ago, around Christmas time, I happened to be in Boston, and it was an unexpected part of the visit. I was asked while there, Harvard University Divinity School was having a preview of a film on spirituality today, and they would like to know if you would be one of the panelists for that preview of that film. I didn't even know I didn't know what to say, so I, you know, what's it all about? Anyway, I ended up being a panelist, and there was a representative of Islam, a professor, tenured professor at Harvard Divinity School in Islam, and a tenured professor of Christianity, a Jesuit priest and professor, and I was the token Hindu. Okay. And then a whole assembly of people that were, because it was, the undergraduate classes had gone, it was all graduate students and professors, and I felt like, you know, the vibration of intelligence in that room. But the film, one of the pieces, one of the segments of the film was ritual. So, and in world religion classes today, contemporary, how it's taught in academic circles, at least in high school, particularly in high school and undergraduate schools. The focus is what differentiates, one of the principal differentiating features of religions is ritual. This religion has this ritual, that religion has that ritual. We know that for a fact because at our temple in Chicago, there are different professors, high school and college, that bring their students. And some, like Bible school study professors, bring their students to our temple at a particular time. It's when they can experience our rituals from their perspective. We have our deity greeting, that's a ritual. We have Guru Puja, that's a ritual. We sit down and sing Jai Radha Madhava, that's a ritual. And we have our morning class, that's a ritual. So they come during that time, and then we questions, and we give them some refreshments and prasadam, and off they go. So ritual, whatever it may be, of this religion, that religion, without compassion, Christ's teaching is empty. Although, so the distinction is not really, the essence is not really where the distinction lies. The essence is, according to Christ's teaching, in this spirit of compassion or knowledge. You may know this or know that, and that this knowledge and that knowledge amongst religion may differ. But the essence is not this piece of information, that piece of information. It's the mood of compassion, the mood of devotion and compassion that connects one to the Supreme. And who is this a picture of? Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva is the compiler of the Vedas, and he did that compiling of the Vedas out of compassion, because Vyasadeva, as you see coming out of his eyes, is light. He's called a rishi. He's a seer. And as a seer, he had the capacity of seeing past, present, and future equally and perfectly. So he looked into the future, saw the coming of this present age, Kali Yuga, and went, yikes, it's horrible. And feeling compassion, he wanted to do something for the people that would be passing through Kali Yuga, like we are. So because he's a literary person, he used a literary expression of compassion. He took the Vedas that were in a within a tradition of sound, and he put them in writing, because people in this age would have short memories they couldn't remember. So he wrote it down, and he made it easy. He divided the one Veda into four and wrote corollary literatures that explained them, wrote a summary of Vedanta Sutra, explained that. He was very compassionate in his efforts to relieve the suffering of this present age, our contemporary age. And here's one statement that he wrote about compassion. Great philanthropic souls travel on earth on behalf of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to show compassion to the fallen souls who are averse to the sense of subordination to the Lord. So for him, compassion was recognizing what's the source of suffering. The source of suffering is an aversion to our sense of subordination to the Lord, and compassion was addressing that root problem, helping those souls who have that aversion to get on the other side of that aversion and again connect with the Supreme. Krishna also directly exhibited compassion. Here's one where he's exhibiting compassion on Arjuna, because Arjuna was in great turmoil about what he should do, what his duty was. So Krishna compassionately expressed Bhagavad Gita. This quote is not from Bhagavad Gita, it's from Srimad Bhagavatam, but Krishna is speaking, where he says, showing compassion to all living entities, you will attain self-realization. Giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me and myself in you. Which is very mysterious. Again, compassion is the centerpiece, but Krishna is saying that through compassion, self-realization, by being compassionate upon others, you will come to realize your true nature, your spiritual nature. And as you act in that compassionate way, giving assurance of safety to all, you will perceive your own self as well as all the universes in me. So let's do that one again, third time. you'll see yourself as well as all the universes in me. I mean, all the universes in Krishna, and then Krishna is inside you. That means all the universes and Krishna and yourself are inside yourself. Like, what's that? Take the key of compassion and the mystery unfolds. It has its similar message in the 9th chapter Bhagavad Gita. I call it Upanishadic double talk, where everything is in Krishna and yet everything is not in Krishna. He's outside of everything. It has to do with the nature of Krishna and his energies. God's energies are everywhere, and so everything is in his energies, but he has his own existence because he's the energetic. But understanding that, it can be accessed when selfishness is relinquished and compassion is taken up instead. This is Krishna speaking in the 3rd canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. And Srila Prabhupada also spoke about compassion. That is the definition of compassion, one who cannot bear the suffering of another. Great unalloyed devotees of the Lord are compassionate towards the fallen, and therefore they travel all over the world with the mission of bringing souls back to Godhead, back to home. Which is very similar to what Vyasadeva said. No error in that similarity. Now, here's a amusing section, or a fun section, where compassion is normally thought of as from one human to another human. One human sees another human in a difficult circumstance, feels compassion, and does something. But compassion can also be for other living entities, other forms of life. Save the whales, save the porpoises. Remember that property we were looking at in Naperville? It was Save the Salamanders. That was a nice property. And it was like on the market forever, and it was at a very low price, and you know, good location. So we went to look at it, and we said, oh, there's environmental issues here. There's wetlands, and there's salamanders, and dealing with the environmentalists would be just like a nightmare. So we just turned and walked away from it. Compassion to other forms of life besides humans. But what about other species and other species? So here's a little pussycat huddled up by the side of a wall, and that little puppy that doesn't know what to make of that little pussycat that's over there, but he's feeling very tired, and so he cuddles up to the pussycat and they both fall asleep. Little baby monkey and I don't know, pigeon or a dove or whatever. And I never really thought of giraffes as compassionate, but the squirrel doesn't seem to mind it at all. And even her own chick is by the side and she's looking after the little other species there. Looking around and making sure that everything is safe. Notice something unique about this guy. What are these called? These are called meerkats. So, just outside in Gita Nagari, where I stay at the Institute House, there's some groundhogs. There's a mama and a papa and two little babies. And they come out of their hole and they stand on their back leg and look around. So they're scouting, is there danger? So the other cat is helping the other meerkats look out for danger. But it isn't always cooperation like this. Sometimes it's like this. So We want to stay away from that kind of a situation. In contemporary society, there's a very strong trend, again, towards modern manifestations of compassion, and one of them is Marshall Rosenberg's work in nonviolent communication. In fact, it has this acronym now, NVC, nonviolent communication. Compassion means that you care about another, and communication can be just passing information from person A to person B. But compassionate communication is where you care not only that the information is passed, but you care about how the other person feels, about how the communication was passed. So he has a whole extended presentation. Like, I know one devotee that took a 5-day seminar and came back and like is helping others to understand these principles of how you can transfer information compassionately or the opposite, or violently. Just like in Bhagavad Gita, our teaching is austerity of speech is speaking the truth pleasingly. Right? 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Speaking the truth, that's a quality of goodness. You don't speak lies, you speak only the truth. To speak the truth pleasingly, that can be challenging sometimes, because sometimes people don't want to hear the truth. And anyway, there's so many different versions of how to communicate effectively, where it's, so he has training in how to. And what part of the training is these little puppets. This is jackal speak. He says, here's the content to pass on. And jackal speak goes, rah, 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 rah. And he says the thing, you know, in a harsh tone. And then how does the other person feel? It doesn't feel good. Then, I guess this is a giraffe. Giraffe is this compassionate guy that he says it compassionately. So, this is an example. Reason for this slide is this is an example of compassion in a contemporary way in the area of communication. And social activism is huge in modern society. One example is that 2 years ago there was a study both in Europe and in America for entering freshmen, and the question was, what's the main criterion that you're using for deciding the career that you're going to enter into? And the overwhelming message was, where it's going to make a difference in the quality of life, in the world in which I live. And then the next question was, well, what about job security, or about how much you'll earn, or those kinds of things? And the answer was, no, I've seen people, my parents, or within society, people have lots of, and they're not happy, and they're not really adding to the quality of life, they're helping deteriorate the quality of life. I don't want that. I want to make the world a better place. And another example is the Peace Corps. The number of students that I've spoken to, that I've known for years as they're developing their careers, and ask them, okay, what's next? And it's particularly young Americans, they say, oh, I'm going to join the Peace Corps for 2 years. Like, just check out. And, you know, what the reward is the reward of doing something that's meaningful for others. It's not going to be a big star in their resume of their education. They're not going to start earning money right away. They're just going to do something that really means something to them. When I was in undergraduate school, the Peace Corps was big. And it was for another decade, and then I thought it died. But it didn't. It just didn't have the same popularity, and now it's rising. I can give other examples, but social activism is major in the world, particularly young people, but the world also. Now, how do you go about training and providing education in the realm of compassion? And the answer is it's very difficult. You can teach a behavior, but how do you develop qualities or character or the quality of compassion in a setting not too much different than this one? One time I was at a home program, I don't even remember where it was, and I started speaking about this point, that basically my message was that character is what the essence of what education is, and without character you don't really have education. You have information, but you don't have education. And as I was expressing this, one person in the audience started like convulsing. I thought they had like a medical problem. I just stopped. I thought, "Are you okay?" And they started crying. I said, "Yes, I'm okay, but what you're saying is true. I've been an educator for so many years, and we know that education is failing. Test scores are better and better, and so many people graduating from schools. But look what happens. We have so many problems with violence in the schools and murders in the schools and bad behavior and corruption. And we recognize we're failing, and so we've tried for the last 5 years, the Board of Education and the teachers, and we're trying this and trying that, and nothing's working. We don't know how to teach these things." Like, trembling and crying. And I said, "Well, do you think it might have something to do with the doctrine of separation of church and state? That you can't bring God into the school, and so you can't have character that's based on God consciousness or connecting to God? You just can't do it, and so you're not going to get the outcome that you want." He said, "Well, we can't go there. We don't know what to do." How do you teach gratitude? I've spoken about this many times. It's one thing parents all over the world, they teach their children to say thank you, like those little toys. You tilt them and the little recording comes and says something. So you tilt the child and the child says thank you. There's no feeling, it's just a behavior. How do you teach gratitude, feeling, gratitude? Parents know what I'm talking about. Respect. You can demand behavior that says, you know, respect. But the feeling of respect, how does that something you communicate? Or compassion. The Vedic wisdom has a model. And the model says, by association with one who has the quality of compassion, at least the opportunity is provided to develop the quality of compassion. And even if you have the opportunity to associate with a person who has qualities like that, it may not imbibe into the individual, within the individual. And so there's another dimension that's very important. That is, one's heart must be open when in that association. Then this transformation can take place. And for that heart to be open, there has to be faith or trust. Because otherwise I'm vulnerable. I don't want to open, because who knows what might happen. Put it in a very succinct message. In the Vedic model, there's a very important relationship between teacher and student. Very deep, very genuine. The purpose of that relationship is not information transferal. It's development of character. And when that deep and genuine relationship is there, provided the teacher has that character, the student has an eagerness to receive it, then it becomes possible. That's the Vedic model. Now here's another from the Vedic perspective. on development of character, training and educating character or qualities. And there's the concept of swabhava. And for those of you that don't know what that is, you're like me. Because I didn't grow up learning Sanskrit or anything like it, and I like Sanskrit for that reason. It's a new word. And so when you hear a new word, it's like you hear all about what that is, and then it becomes a symbol of something. And it's like a new word in your vocabulary. So here's what swabhava is, how it's used in Bhagavad Gita. It's describing different types of people. Brahma karma swabhavajam, kshatriya karma swabhavajam, vaishya karma swabhavajam, shudra karma swabhavajam. Swabhava means nature. Sva, S-V-A, means one's own. And bhava means feeling, or quality, or nature. So according to the association of an individual with the modes of nature, they have different swabhava. Here it is in a picture form. Real simple. In the center, there's the soul. That's us. And surrounding the soul, there's a subtle body, material elements, mind, intelligence, false ego, and a gross body, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. Those two things, gross and subtle body, that's not who we are. We're the soul inside. But it's not like a static atmosphere. There's modes of nature that are acting on both the gross and subtle body. This one that just intruded, that's the mode of goodness. And it acts upon the gross and subtle body. And the mode of passion acts on the gross and subtle body and the mode of ignorance. And they're influencing or impelling the gross and the subtle body in different ways. When the quality of goodness prevails, then from that swabhava, or that nature of goodness, you get some behaviors. And in this Google employee TED speaker said, same thing. From character comes behavior. So compassion, the measurable part is the behaviors of compassion, or its opposite. But where does it come from? It comes from in the Sanskrit term, swabhava. So if we can cultivate the quality of goodness in our life, then compassion is going to follow. There's other modes of nature that are competing, and so we want to continue with regulation in our habits and cleanliness and truthfulness and all the components that are described in Bhagavad Gita, the foods that we eat and happiness and discretionary time and recreation and so many things. Where we live, just like just looking out the window, it's not cement and, you know, highways, it's trees and birds and wildlife. It's the setting is a mode of goodness setting. It promotes the atmosphere in which you live promotes the quality of goodness if it's like this. And again, behaviors will come. So a Vedic model is cultivate the quality of goodness and compassion will come. Respect will come. And so characteristics of the quality of goodness will come. That's the Vedic model. So compassion is a trait of the mode of goodness. And one example of that from the Vedic literature is King Rantidev. I'm going to describe that quickly. Rantidev was a very pious king, loved and respected, and his kingdom was very prosperous because he was so pious. The citizens share in the piety of the king And the opposite is true. The citizens and share in the impiety of the king. And the opposite is also true. The impiety of the citizens is borne by the king. In Prithu Maharaja's description in the fourth canto, he praises his citizens because you're doing so many pious activities, of which one-sixth of which I'm getting the benefit. So thank you very much for being pious citizens. Ranti Dev was known especially for his quality of being compassionate and charitable. So one day, or one time, he decided he would undergo some extended sacrifice or austerity, which would bring piety to him, and then he wished to distribute that piety to his citizens. So he planned to undergo a fast for a very long time. He had great capacity, which we would die if we tried to do what he did. He fasted for 100 days. That's a long time to fast. And at the end of the fast, they made a royal feast in the royal kitchen and sat him on the royal throne, and there he was ready to break his fast. And just as he was ready to break his fast, a learned Brahmin came into the royal assembly. Immediately, the king stood up, got off his royal seat, greeted the Brahmin, the priest, and requested the Brahmin to sit on his throne and break the fast first. How auspicious. You break the fast, and then I'll break the fast. That will be very auspicious. So, being honored so nicely by the king, the Brahmin took half, and he left the other half. And when he left, the king sat down to break his fast. Remember, it's been 100 days. Just as he was ready to break the fast, this gentleman came in with a bunch of puppies. He said, "My puppies are very hungry. Can I have something for them?" He said, "Yes, certainly. You take everything that's here. We'll just have my people transfer it to a place and they can take, and I'll just keep this cup of water and break my fast with the cup of water." So the puppies ate, and then as he was getting ready to drink the water, a thirsty beggar came begging for some refreshment, some water. And the king said, "What great fortune it is that in this human form of life we can do something that can be of value and benefit to others. How fortunate I am that you've come just at this time. Thank you very much." And he gave him his cup of water. The end of the narration is that those personalities were Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma and Lord Indra, who wanted to test. They heard about Ranti Dev and heard that he was very magnanimous and charitable. They wanted to see what was the limit. So they came as these personalities to test him. And he got an A in his exam. So they blessed him, saying that, "May you achieve the ultimate destination of life after this life because of your noble quality." In contemporary life, Mother Teresa is certainly so well known for whatever little bit that she had, she saw how to use it in the benefit of others, just driven by this sense of compassion. In our temple, we had some government person here in Chicago who was like a Mother Teresa fan, who had gone there, and he was telling stories about how frugal she was. She wouldn't spend anything for anything because she saw it as, you know, it's so many loaves of bread or so many blankets, or, you know, how it translated into how she could help other people. So she was so conscientious about anything that came into her care because it meant opportunity or for some facility for some act of compassion for others. Compassion can look very differently, as it looks here. This is Maharaj Parikshit, who came because this personality disguised as a king was using this club for smashing and breaking the legs of a bull. And when he heard that, out of compassion for the abused cow, bull, immediately came to chastise, sword raised, ready to punish him. So our compassion shouldn't be like Maharaj Pariksit running around with swords and chopping people. But if one is a king, if it's one's duty to protect, then if there are innocent persons who are victims, and being exploited, then it may be the king's duty to exercise compassion in that way. Just winding up, two other points. Can compassion be misplaced? This is something that I've thought about a lot. In fact, I think just before I went to India, I gave a presentation at the Sunday program in New York on as one gradually becomes spiritually more evolved, a little bit, then this quality of compassion also starts to awaken. And then it becomes a question, where do I repose that compassionate feeling? Can compassion be misplaced? One basic teaching the Prabhupada gave us is that if you see a man that's drowning and you go out and rescue his coat and bring the coat back to the shore, what have you accomplished? Nice gesture, little anecdotal story. One sannyasi in our New York temple made a plan for the Sunday feast lecture. He and one brahmachari who was, they had this, nobody knew it but these two, an eccentric brahmachari, believe it or not, was seated along the back row, and you know, the class was going on, and right in the middle of the class, in a very loud, shrill voice, "Help!" Very loud. And everyone stopped, and his arms were like this, "Help!" Just like, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" And the speaker got off the seat and went over, and everybody's crowded around, and "Help!" And then he took his chadar and took his chadar and went back and sat down in the asasan. And then, you know, the brahmachari's writhing on the floor. And then he said, this was a skit to get your full attention so you could understand this message. And then the brahmachari stood up and smiled. And the message was, as with a drowning man, you may save his coat, or with a person that's suffering, you may help them on the external side. But what about the need of the soul inside? If you don't attend to the need of the soul inside and you do something for the outside, it's incomplete, or it's misplaced compassion. Here's another example, a nice kitty cat from just this morning I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and there was these, in the early morning, there were these, I thought it was crickets, but it's some other name that starts with a C, something like that. And I was told that every 13 years, there's a cycle, I don't know what it is, and then these insects come and they don't eat up all the foliage, they just like make all this noise, and then he said in about 2 weeks, thousands and millions of them are going to be all over the road and driveway and your garage and like, you know, it's everywhere. And then they're dead. So when I was small, it was in upstate New York, in the Syracuse area, and there were locusts. This was like every 11 years. Something like that. It was a cycle. I don't know because I moved from there. But when I was like 5 or 6 years old, there was like this infestation of locusts, like thousands and thousands, and they flew in swarms. The sky at night, during the day, would look like it was night, although it was clearly day, just because there were just so many of them. And they would land on agricultural fields, and you could hear them just eating everything. Then they'd fly to another agricultural field and eat everything, and fly to the trees and eat all the trees, the foliage off the trees, and then it would come again another 11 years. So my parents made a mistake. They had me go to the garage with a spray thing of black flag to spray in the garage so we wouldn't have locusts in the garage. So I was doing that, spraying in the garage, and then I saw our cat. I thought, oh, if I spray the cat won't have any problem with locusts. So I sprayed the cat thoroughly. And the next morning, the cat was dead in the garage. And I was one sad little boy. I killed our cat. And I learned a lesson that good intention is not good enough. Or compassion that's misplaced can be actually very detrimental. So one should be very careful about where you repose tendencies for compassion. And Arjuna had the same problem. He got an A in compassion and an F in where he placed it. Krishna certified him. You've placed compassion upon the body and you've forgotten the soul. So let's speak about what the soul is, what the real self is upon whom compassion should be exhibited. And Bharat Maharaj is another. So because of time, I'll go quickly. But as king, he was such a great king, they didn't just name a street after him or a building after him or an airport after him. They named the planet after him. He was such a great king. And while he was king, he continued to progress spiritually and took care of his citizens. And when his children were of age, he turned the kingdom over to them and then went to the forest. Shown here, he's meditating on Surya Narayan in the Gayatri Mantra. And achieved the stage that we know as Bhava Bhakti, like just before the stage of spiritual perfection, Prema. And he was up there spiritually. And one fateful day, as he went early in the morning to do his morning duties, performed, had his morning bath, and was seated by the side of the river, chanting his mantra, he saw on the opposite side a female deer drinking water. Female deer was pregnant. She was looking, drinking, and all of a sudden a very loud roar of a lion that startled her so much she simultaneously had a miscarriage, and the baby fawn was born, and she jumped in the air and fell into the river and was carried downstream by the river, crawled to the edge of the river and into a cave and died. And there's the baby fawn floating down the river. And the king, former king, is seeing this happen. So naturally, being a protector of the citizens of his kingdom, the king went to rescue the baby deer. And he understood exactly what that meant, that the baby deer had no mother. There was no indication of where the father of the deer was. So he became everything. He took the mother, father, friend, caretaker, everything. His all in all for the baby deer. And as the deer was growing up, his full consciousness became absorbed in the deer. So even when he was doing his religious duties, he was not able to be focused. And in course of time, actually rather quickly, he stopped his spiritual practices. And he rationalized the whole thing. It was deliberate. He consciously chose, let me stop my spiritual practices and thinking of the Lord. And he chose instead to absorb himself in thinking of the deer. And he fell from his spiritual position. So one night, the deer disappeared, and he was, there's like verses and verses of his monologue of, oh, such a pious living entity, I've offended them. That's so they've left. But they're very compassionate, and surely they'll come back and forgive me. And on and on and on, and the deer didn't come back. So in the morning he went to look for the deer, and as he was looking, he fell off a cliff. And he fell in the bottom of the jagged rocks and thinking of the deer at the time of death. And so he became a deer. Or the soul left the body and he took the body of a deer in his next life. So quickly, it was the right thing to do for a person of his position to do something to rescue the baby deer. But it was the wrong thing to do to become so attached, obsessed in his attachment, that his spiritual purpose of life was just gone. And he consciously chose like that. So that was misplaced compassion. And didn't have a good consequence. So now, another question, is there such a thing as swabhava on the platform of the soul itself? We spoke about swabhava as that which affects the body and the mind, associating with the modes of nature. But beyond the modes of nature, is there compassion on the platform of the soul? And there are studies on this, and one of the persons that studied this is Dr. Kristen Neff. Not exactly in the language that I just described, but as you see here, this is the title of her book, Stop Beating Yourself Up and Leave Insecurity Behind, Self-Compassion, where her studies show that persons, to help themselves, either one of two sides. One is they extend and extend and extend and extend and extend, and they become depleted. So one has to receive, one has to be a receiver of compassion in order to give compassion. Or they may be forgiving of other people, but they don't forgive themselves. So there's a role for self-compassion in compassion. And one question might be, is there such a thing as, is this real compassion, or is it just covered narcissism, just like somebody being absorbed in themselves? And the answer is that if it's on the platform of the soul, if one can come to the platform of the soul, then it's beneficial. So how do you come to the spiritual platform? How do you take self-compassion to the spiritual platform? And in this age of Kali, it's very difficult, if you haven't noticed. The picture of the age of Kali from the Vedic literature matches what's going on, and it's the atmosphere is surcharged with opposition in the language of the Bhagavatam. And to find a compassionate person, a person of quality or character to associate with, or to find a person who is willing to move to that position, it's very rare. So it's problematic. The present age that we're in is very problematic. And the Vedic wisdom is aware of this and offers a remedy. The remedy is sound vibration through sacred sound or spiritual sound or the sound of the holy name. One can be lifted at once to that spiritual realm, spiritual consciousness, spiritual conception. Here's a statement from the 12th canto Bhagavatam. Simply by chanting the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, one can become free from material bondage and be promoted to the transcendental kingdom. This is from the same chapter that describes the age of Kali in the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam. And the process can be applied in a very practical way. in congregational chanting, persons whose lives may be troubled or, you know, different conditions of victimized by the age of Kali. But it's a very joyful process, and it awakens spiritual consciousness very quickly and very naturally. Or by solitary chanting in a peaceful setting is ideal, but where that sound vibration is something that one regularly accesses, it can awaken the dormant spiritual consciousness very effectively. And from that, the antidote for this age of Kali can be found. And this is the last slide. Back to Krishna's compassionate nature, not only on the platform of the soul. That platform, the soul has a natural quality of compassion, or a swabhava of compassion, because that's within Krishna, and we're part and parcel of Krishna. So if our consciousness of the Supreme can be restored, if we can turn our attention in that way, then it's the best opportunity for compassion to be revived. So there's some thoughts on our topic, exercising compassion in contemporary life. Any comments or questions? Yeah.
When you were talking about King, what was it, Renti Day?
About?
The King Renti Day?
Yeah, Marshall Rosenberg.
The story when he was fasting.
Oh, King Ranti Dev.
Yeah.
Okay.
When he was fasting. And so he had a difficulty, which was that he was hungry, but he saw it not as a difficulty, he saw it as a way to exercise compassion. So the question that I have is, when we have so many situations that come about in our lives, how can we see them rather than difficult situations? Rather than getting stressed out by them, how can we see them as a way to not just exercise compassion towards others, but to deepen our relationship with Krishna and with the spiritual master?
By being Krishna conscious, by hit the reset button and ask yourself the question that the Brahma asked himself, or thoughtful people ask themselves, who am I really? It's go back to basics, and by being introspective, watch the unfolding of events of life, and the lessons of nature, and the guidance of wisdom, literature, and by following the process that's recommended, being introspective and taking proper guidance from proper sources, you can get that realization, and then it's not just gritting your teeth and bearing difficult circumstances, but going through those difficult circumstances in Krishna consciousness. Follow the process. Starts with inquisitiveness. And then in that question, as the Bible says, seek and ye shall find. So with an inquisitive spirit, facilities to take us to the answer will be provided. And then we take another step, and another step, and another step. So by gradually cultivating our dormant God consciousness, that's how that can happen. That's how to. Premananda?
Yes, you might have said it's amazing. I don't know. There's too many thoughts out there. I still have to sort it out. But anyway, I just have a bit of curiosity, just a quick question regarding Haiti. With the proper understanding of compassion, devotees are going to places like that. And I heard that it's a place where people practice a lot of black magic. And so when we are extending compassion in such a place, what is the receiving side of it?
What was the punchline? What is the...
How do they receive it? Because you, even when you extend compassion with the right consciousness...
Well, in that particular circumstance, they received it readily because their lives were smashed. Now what happened, you know, 1 year later, 2 years later, that's another thing. It's like a practical experience I had was in New York City in the 1 month after 9/11. Everybody was so religious. And, you know, go to the same places where they had vigils, and it's, you know, it's not religious anymore. The sobriety is gone. You've heard me describe what that experience is like. So, when they went at that time, there was an enormous receptivity. People that might not have otherwise been receptive were very receptive. They were smashed. And they were happy to receive not only, you know, material necessities, they're happy to receive spiritual truth, spiritual reality. But when life becomes back to normal, that's another thing. So is that what your question is more, when life gets back to normal, how do you help such people?
No, actually I was thinking about the people in Haiti. I heard they practice black magic.
I heard that part.
Yeah. So I was thinking, if you are in that kind of a consciousness, even...
What do people in New York City practice?
I don't know.
Aggression. It's another mode of nature. But they became very religious. I mean, on every street corner, where, you know, it's, you know, the walk, don't walk, they had shrines. And when it's business as usual, it's like they're running in front of the cars just to get to the other side of the street, you know, so they can get the dollar on the other, you know, the, whatever the thing is, it's at the other end that they're running after. It's, you know, and somebody gets in the way, you push them out of the way. It's just like, you know, aggressive. It's not black magic. It's, you know, it's not the mode of ignorance. It's the mode of passion. It's certainly not the mode of goodness. But people became, you know, very inspired to turn to God.
Okay.
Anything else? Yes? You, Ashraya.
I was just kind of lamenting. My brother and his wife, they both went to the Peace Corps for like 3 years, and they live in Portland, and I saw that you did this presentation in Portland, and I didn't think to send them to the program, so I was feeling that. I wish I had. So if there's any opportunity for you to go back to them, like, they went to the University of Oregon, maybe I can set something up for them.
Is this in Corvallis?
The university?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm fine.
You don't know?
Okay.
Okay. Because there are devotees in Corvallis.
Was Portland just a home program?
Yeah, it was someone's home. Anything else? Yeah.
I have two questions, not very well formulated perhaps. One is about the first couple of slides, wherein there was three components, feeling, understanding, and I forget the last point.
Motivation.
Motivation. Thank you. So I'm trying to understand the difference between the feeling and the understanding. Somehow I seem to understand that if I feel only, then I can understand. Is that true? If I feel, that particular distress, only then I can understand the other person's suffering. Is that correct? Or wrong?
Well, one without the other is incomplete. Your understanding will be incomplete if you don't feel, if you don't have compassionate concern, an affective component, minus the affective component, your understanding will be incomplete. The other question?
My understanding is that compassion can only be extended to a person in need. That means, so the way I'm understanding that is, if I'm in a better position than the other person, only then I can extend compassion.
No. Who is there that's not in need? It's not looking down. I'm up here, they're down there. From a Bhagavad Gita perspective, when there's a soul that's in the material body, that's and the material atmosphere that's surrounding the material body, that's an unnatural and a very uncomfortable position. Whatever, high or lower. And so there's suffering, or there's some misfortune just due to that circumstance.
But at the same time, I cannot show compassion to my superiors.
Why not? That's like, say, when Prabhupada was leaving this world, and he was on his deathbed, literally. Mm-hmm. And just seeing him in that condition, maybe you've seen videos of what that was like. You feel something. Mm-hmm. You understand, you know, from looking at what his body looked like in that condition. Very difficult. You can feel compassion for someone that maybe in a superior position. How much difficulty they must be undergoing. So it's not, I'm up here, they're down there. It's that's not the program. The program is someone you feel for someone's difficulty. And to some degree, some understanding of what they're undergoing. There was a in our Brooklyn temple one time. There was a devotee that had kidney stones, and he had to be taken to a place where they had his kidney stones removed. And there was a devotee, a woman, that was sharing with me how painful it is. And, you know, I've never given birth to a child, obviously. But she said, I've given birth to two children, and I had kidney stones. And kidney stones were more painful. And, you know, I don't know what it's like to have either, but I could understand from what she said, it's really painful. Yes.
You established that the link between
compassion and social activism. And then after the instruction, I thought I read that all those isms can at times be extended self.
Yes, they can be misplaced. If it's neglect of the soul. Let's go to a spiritual order or spiritual level of spiritual plane of consciousness. In a spiritual plane of consciousness with a holistic picture, Atma can mean soul, but Atma can also mean body or mind or combination. The living entity can mean the soul, but the living entity can mean, you know, the whole being. So we look after the whole being for the purpose of the well-being, the liberating of the soul from the material circumstances altogether. And then, so acting this presentation was not for people that are, you know, paramahansas, topmost realized souls. It's for college students to understand this is an exhibition of compassion in modern time. But now, from a devotional perspective, because you're bringing in nectar of instruction, we don't say, don't care. You know, because after all, you're just spirit soul. So just like, let the body rot and let minds, you know, do whatever they're going to do. Just because that's not going to be effective. Because those things also need to be proper, in proper order, so that one can function properly towards the spiritual objective. Then it's no longer just an ism, it's part of the whole picture of elevating the consciousness of the soul to the ultimate purpose of life. Are we okay with that?
Yeah. So how do we
keep the soul in the center? Keep the soul in the center, the well-being of the soul. So when you rescue the drowning person, don't just bring his coat. When you go to Haiti, don't just, you know, give people food and medicine. Give people food and medicine. But attend to the needs of the soul. The purpose of whatever are the all the other things that make up life, ultimately all those other things that are meant for bringing the soul to the state of pure consciousness. So do those things. And some your fellow man or person or entity, that some your neighbor is having a problem, we extend ourselves to help them. And our consciousness should be, you know, at the center. God consciousness is at the center as we extend ourselves. Yes?
Narada Maharaj, he was actually exhibiting his swabhava on the platform of the soul.
He was almost at the stage of perfection.
He
consciously chose something else.
So that's the thing. How can such a person, in a rationalization, how can it
happen? Free will is operable at all times. The good news is, Krishna helped him. He forgot, but Krishna didn't forget. So Krishna helped him get, again, properly situated. Yes?
I was trying to understand one of the slides you presented in the last, comparing between the real compassion and covert narcissism, or too much focus on oneself.
Okay.
That's where I understood. So I'm trying to differentiate.
The distinction was, if it's on the platform of the soul, then it's not. That's very simple. Don't go too far with that one. And then the next slide was how to get on the platform of the soul. How to ensure. And then it's difficult in this age of Kali.
Is it the mood of service?
Well, it's the spiritual conception. Because you, yes.
I'm just coming back to this slide.
This one.
I feel for you, the first component. So when another person is suffering, whatever range of suffering that they're having, they're going through some feeling. A person is showing compassion for them. Is it that they feel the same way, or is the
how can that be possible? We're individuals.
So, what is the feeling that I, as a person giving compassion, feel?
I may not know what you're feeling, but I'm not feeling your feeling. But I know that you're undergoing some difficulty, and for that, I have some feeling. To some degree, it can be, empathy. Like Narada Muni speaks about Nala Kuvera and Manigriva by saying, if they're in a situation where they're deprived, then more likely this condition of pride that's in their heart will go. And he gives the example of one who's been pricked by a thorn. When he sees another person pricked by a thorn, he feels compassion for the person who's being pricked by a thorn, because he knows what the feeling is like. But that person who's being pricked by the thorn, it may not be exactly what my feeling is. Or, like this example of this woman who's telling me how painful kidney stones are. I don't know what either of them are, but I can understand it's very painful. So one can feel compassion. The affective component can be there even if it's outside of your experience. Okay? Okay, we're done. Yes? No? Yes? Okay. Yes.
From verse in Bhagavatam, just generally understanding, if we strive for attaining a real quality, ultimately we have to come to a spiritual platform to achieve it. But it seems like compassion is something that's more placed importance on our facilitates that more, maybe, than just thinking of some of the quality that doesn't involve interaction with others in an explicit way. Is that, I'm just saying it very simply.
Well, in that education and training, those, respect, that's interpersonal. Gratitude, that's interpersonal. Qualities, ultimately, because everything is based on person, it's interpersonal. Qualities are, at least in relation to God, so it's interpersonal. And then we act with that quality. Okay. Sometimes we get too caught up in improving our own Krishna consciousness and creating our own comfortable situation in Krishna consciousness where we feel happy and secure. Is this being selfish? When we find this safe situation, we tend to forget to extend compassion to others because we are so content with our own position in Krishna consciousness. If this is a form of self-centeredness, how do we guard ourselves from this mentality and always feel the eagerness to extend compassion to others? complacency is not a spiritual quality. Say it the other way around. When one has spiritual quality, they're not feeling complacent. They're not feeling, I'm contented. Like a classic example from our perspective, our tradition is Prahlad. His prayer was, please deliver these persons who don't know what real happiness is, or what their suffering condition is, and how to get relieved from it. I don't want the complacency. It just doesn't. There's no space for it. That is to say, compassion, real spiritual well-being, has as its natural component a concern for others. When real spiritual well-being is awakening, compassion is going to be there. So the answer to the first part is yes, it's a kind of self-centeredness or selfishness that I'm interested in my own well-being, and other people can rot, that's okay. I'm interested in my own well-being. That's not a spiritual position. At the same time, or on the other hand, I can't effectively give something to others if I don't have it. So I have to, I certainly, the component of one's life is to cultivate spiritual wellness. And when spiritual wellness is there, a component will be the concern for the spiritual wellness of those around me. And then that circle expands. If it's real, it's the real deal. If it's the real thing, it will be present and it will expand. And if it's absent, it's not this contentment in one's own spiritual situation in Krishna consciousness. It's artificial. It's just a bubble waiting to burst. Something will happen, and that well-being. And, it's gone. What to speak of any capacity to help somebody else? It's just not what a spiritual position is. One follows the other. One spiritual well-being is followed by the concern for the well-being of others around you. It's just natural. How do we guard ourselves from this mentality? Just the examples of our great Vaishnavas, start with Lord Chaitanya, or take your pick, and the followers of Lord Chaitanya, or Prahlad Maharaj, or so many personalities in our spiritual line. It's just some affinity for those personalities, and it's the guiding light to take you to the right position. Protection. One more question. One last question.
I believe in the next slide, you had a somewhat surprising word, or the same slide here. Ambition. How do I understand this?
Depends on what your frame of reference is. If you're a Google employee, it's one perspective. And if you're a Krishna devotee, it's another perspective. The ambition of a Krishna devotee is to pursue those things very, very actively that will help those who are in a difficult circumstance to be relieved of that difficult circumstance. To expand God consciousness, or the opportunity for others to access it. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
So, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.